Anyway, I was wondering if you could talk about the Global Warming Task Force and how far along it is at this point.
The task force charge from the governor is to recommend goals for the state in terms of greenhouse gas emission reductions and set a panoply of different policies that would get us to, or would help us to meet those goals. And the task force originally, it consists of 29 different people with a lot of different perspectives. We did some education, first of all, to bring everybody up to speed on the issues. But the governor made clear that our job is not to debate the science. His order accepts the science that there's substantial human contribution. Global warming is occurring and substantial human contribution to it, and our job is the more practical job of how can Wisconsin do its part in addressing the issue. So we did not debate the science, but we had some background on the different sectors, because, for instance, the utility guys know the utility industry, but they don't know forestry and ag issues, and et cetera. So we did that, and then we divided up into work groups in order to develop policy templates that would then be brought back to the full task force. And that's what has been going on all summer and is coming close to completion. So we have energy conservation and efficiency group. We have a energy supply side, that would be new generation, supply side, the efficiency of existing generation, retirements. We have an ag forestry group that is looking at both agricultural practices and forestry. Interesting, that group, forestry, is in some ways a sink as much as a source, so that's a little bit different. We have transportation group, that would be the second largest sector in terms of contributions. And the final one is a miscellaneous other industry group, which would include small engines and paper companies and just a variety of sources. Each group is supposed to come up with a limited number of policies that look at a variety of issues. That is, you know, identification of the policy, the potential reduction in greenhouse gases, some rough estimate of cost, both administrative and other, and then defining the policy as carefully as we can. And then finally, identifying the obstacles. Some policies could be, you know, an example of a policy that would have a significant impact, but is probably politically very, very difficult, would be reducing the speed limit to, you know, 55 or 45 or something like that. So the practicality of feasibility is also part of it. Those will all be brought back to the task force as a whole. We're hoping that a large percent of them, there will be strong consensus, if not unanimity, within the work groups, but there'll be a few which present difficult issues. For instance, whether to adopt the California vehicle emissions versus the federal vehicle emissions standard is always a big issue in these efforts. And there will be other nuclear moratorium on power plants that will have to come back to the full group. And then the full group will adopt a set of policy recommendations, but there will be an opportunity to dissent, so and with that view specified. And then one of the most difficult things is really getting a handle on impacts. And so we have the World Resource Institute, WRI, advising the work groups. They've done this elsewhere and have some expertise. But then we also have to do modeling. And so we've retained a modeling group that has the capability of cross-sector modeling, which is very hard to find. What everyone tells us is that when you model the groups of policies together, you'll get significantly less reduction in emissions than if you add up the sum of each individual policy, because they overlap. In other words, if you have a lot of energy conservation, then the amount of savings you get from a different energy policy goes down because the load is down. And so there's a lot of interaction between policies that need to be recognized. Vehicles. If you have a lot of people purchasing plug-in hybrids, then reducing the speed limit produces less saving. So you have to see how the policies interact in order to do that. So we will go through, first of all, we have to establish a reference case, which is business as usual. What if current trends continue, but we take no specific new actions to address this issue? Where are we going? And then we need to model policy bundles against that reference case to see what the reductions would be, and then set a target. I mean, I think clearly, we're looking at stabilizing and then reducing. If you look out there, states, a lot of states have gone to a target of 1990 levels in 2020, and then they've adopted different targets in 2050, between 50% less or 80% less. I'm not sure where the Wisconsin group, I'm not sure where it will come out on any particular issue. That's the task force's judgment. But that's the process we're going through. And then ultimately there'll be a set of recommendations.
And when will the recommendations be?
Well, the governor's order had asked for it to be by the end of the year. I don't think that's going to be possible because I don't think the modeling will be done. We want to do a good job. It's more important to do a good job than to meet an artificial deadline. And so I think he understands that it will take a little bit longer. One of the problems is that, you know, there's a lot of other states that are going through a similar process, and there are a limited number of consultants out there with real expertise. And so these guys are tending to work in multiple states, and they're stretched pretty thin. And so the timeline, it's going to take a bit longer, but I'm not sure what the date. And it's possible we'll issue some interim report and then a final report.
And then ultimately these would have to be enacted by the legislature.
Right. I mean, we've got to identify. Some policies are ones that, for instance, the agency, PSC, or governor's office or somebody could implement. Others require, a lot of them would require legislation. And then at the same time, we have the federal government considering numerous bills. And so that you have the possibility of preemption of certain issues if the federal government ever does anything. So it's kind of a moving target.
What do you think will be the most controversial?
The big ticket items, that vehicle emission standards, nuclear power is always a controversial issue, although less controversial probably than before the greenhouse gas emissions issue came up. I don't think anybody thinks that one could really meet the kind of aggressive targets you're seeing in other states, assuming Wisconsin, Minnesota, and others. Assuming Wisconsin goes down a somewhat similar path without some kind of cap and trade program or carbon tax, and it's hard to find a politician that's in favor of a tax, so cap and trade is a more likely approach.
Wisconsin's been building coal-fired power plants at a good clip.
We built none between 1980. Right. 1985, 1982, 1983, and now.
So playing catch up.
Yeah.
Do these have any, that contributes a lot to
well, that will be in the reference case, and I don't know how the reference case is going to come out, but I'm not sure that it's going to show a significant bump in emissions as a result of those plants.
When you say reference case, that means?
Business as usual.
Okay.
In other words, what will the emissions profile look like going forward if we don't adopt any new policies? And of course, you'll have to build into that reference case the plants under construction. There's an issue as to whether you build ones that are you know, a gleam in somebody's eye, but not permit it. I'm not sure that, I don't know what will happen with those, the three coal-fired plants in construction, because they are much more efficient than existing, and they burn about 20% less coal than the similarly sized older plants. Mm-hmm. They will change the dispatch, so you will see some of the older plants run less. Uh-huh. So it's hard to, we have to be careful until the numbers are run to really, on making assumptions on that.
Is the business community on board with this, or?
Well, I don't think the business community is a monolith.
Right.
I think there's a probably a fairly broad set of different views among the business community. The utility industry in general, if you look at what's going on in Washington and their National Association, Edison Electric Institute, recognizes that there is going to be carbon regulation, mm-hmm. and I think is generally in support of some kind of cap and trade system. They don't want to be the only industry affected. Right. They want it to be multi-sector, which is what the Wisconsin approach is. And then you'll see a variety. I mean, we have some industry in Wisconsin, S.C. Johnson, mm-hmm. Johnson Controls, Flambeau Paper, number of companies, General Motors, that have significant sustainability initiatives going on. They see rising energy costs and so are putting a lot more emphasis on conservation and efficiency of the process and reusing waste materials. So, I think, and if you look nationally, there's a number of Fortune 500 companies that are saying this issue is important and needs to be dealt with. But there will be others that will say that, this is going to drive us out of business or cost significantly. Mm-hmm. Just kind of, there'll be a spectrum of views.
How do you feel about nuclear power?
Is this me?
Yes.
The task force will look at that question. And the question really is whether Wisconsin takes off its moratorium so that it's an option that can be on the table with on-site storage of fuel. My personal view, which is not the task force view, is that the issue of global warming, climate change, is a very significant one, and to say that we can't consider nuclear as an option in the future would be imprudent, because I think the number one priority ought to be, from WPPI's perspective, much more efficient use of energy in the state, and that is what we can do now. Mm-hmm. We have the technology. There's a lot of waste out there.
What percentage would you say is wasted?
I don't know. Okay. I talked to Susan Stratton at the Energy Center, but I'll bet you that I think it's quite significant. Lighting, mm-hmm. We have there's been a lot of change out to complex fluorescence, but the market is nowhere near penetrated. One of the policies that will come forward is whether there should be something that has a lighting efficiency standard or doesn't allow incandescence after a certain point in time, and quantify what that impact would be. But in terms of new generation going forward, if you're not going to build any more traditional coal plants, mm-hmm. which is going to be difficult but could happen, you've really got two choices. One is coal-fired generation that captures the CO2, mm-hmm. and sequesters it. Which means, and that technology, a lot of work's being done on it, but there's not any commercial plants out there. But that requires, that's expensive, A. And B, Wisconsin doesn't have the geology, apparently, for sequestration.
So you'd have to ship it down to Illinois or something?
Right, or more likely, in my view, you build the plant down there so that you're not hauling the coal all the way up here and hauling the CO2 all the way down there. I mean, you might as well just have one haul. And then you need a lot more transmission to get it here. But how well that technology is going to pan out, you know, there's issue concerns about groundwater pollution, and there's concerns about earthquake, and the only other option really is nuclear. So I don't think it's prudent to put all your eggs in one basket. That doesn't mean I think that Wisconsin's going to build a new nuclear plant in the next 10 years. I don't. But when you're talking 2050, I think you have to keep an open mind.
How about a coal gasification plant?
Well, that's a part of the sequestration. One of the the most promising one, I guess, is to take the coal, turn it into gas, capture the carbon CO2 in that process, burn what's left to generate electricity, and then you've got to pipeline it or sequester it. They're also doing an experiment at Pleasant Prairie, We Energies is, with EPRI, the Electric Research Institute, on the possibility of capture from traditional coal plants. Mm-hmm. But most of the focus has been on this IGCC, the coal gasification, which has a capture process. And, you know, people have been capturing CO2 and pumping it into oil wells or whatever, but when you talk about doing it for coal-fired generation, you're talking about a massive scale and a huge amount of CO2 that can be pumped into the ground.
There's a coal-fired plant that's been proposed, I think, by Alliant out along the Mississippi.
Nelson Dewey.
Had you suggested a couple years ago that that be an experimental one for coal gasification, or
no? That Alliant is proposing that plant. It's in the early permitting stages. It's a fairly small plant. It's 300 megawatts. It's a fluidized bed technology, and I'm sure, you know, well, it's already controversial. Any coal plant is controversial. No, we had suggested a couple of years ago that in terms of the gasification technology, mm-hmm. that no one Wisconsin utility is going to step out and build a coal gasification plant. It's too risky for anyone. That if the state did want to move forward with that technology, the way to do it would be to have all the utilities jointly owned on a pro rata basis, that would spread the risk and that we would be willing to participate. That idea hasn't gone very far because subsequent work has said that Wisconsin doesn't really have sequestration geology. If we had sequestration geology, I think you would see that kind of a proposal moving forward. If you have to pipe it to Illinois, that's a whole other ball game in terms of cost and feasibility. I don't know how receptive Illinois is going to be. There's another possibility that some people are looking at, which is to take coal in Illinois, turn it into a gas that would be equivalent to natural gas, piping the gas up here and burning it. Whether the pipelines would accept, you know, there's impurity issues, accept it or not. You do that, you get some benefit, but when you burn that, you still have CO2 emissions equivalent to a gas plant as opposed to a coal plant. So it's
going
to
be a lot less.
It's less, but still, but not the same as an IGCC plant where you capture all the carbon.
Right. So. Does WPPI have any power plants to produce?
Yes, we own 20% of a large coal-fired power plant in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, in Boswell 4. It's run by Minnesota Power. We bought into it in 1990, approximately. Very good, very efficient plant, and actually cleaner than any of the existing plants in the state because we have scrubbers. And there are no scrubbers. The new plants are in construction, will be cleaner, but the existing plants in Wisconsin that have scrubbers. It's a good, we wish we had more of it. And we are partners with We Energies and MGE on the Elm Road units being constructed near Racine, the two 620 megawatt plants. We will own approximately 100 megawatts of that. So we're a small partner. But
how many members are there in WPPI?
There are 49, there are 41 Wisconsin communities that own their own electric utilities that own WPPI. They are legally our members. We also serve, I said 49 because we serve eight additional, or are about to serve eight additional communities in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and Iowa. And we treat them exactly like members, but legally they're not, because we're a Wisconsin political association.
Are they leaving another utility to join you? Or?
Yeah, their contracts expire. The power markets have become a lot more complex, and it used to be that you had a supplier and they would supply it forever if you wanted, but that's not the case anymore. It's hard for these little systems to navigate because they can't diversify their supply. So if they have a contract with X utility and that's expiring, there's no obligation for the utility to renew that contract to the municipality. And so they may say no, or you may go back into the market with an RFP and get no response or very high response. You can't diversify. You know, you would normally want your whole stock portfolio to turn over on the same day, and that's what happens.
So did these communities go to you because they didn't have any other options?
They had options, but they decided that they would rather be a part of a group like this, similarly situated utilities that have a diverse supply, rather than try to navigate it themselves or to go into another like 5 or 10 year contract and face the possibility that it would expire at exactly the wrong time.
I saw a press release, I think it was last week, about WPPI wanting to build a zero net use house in each of your markets or something like that?
Well, no, not quite. We have substantially increased our budget for conservation and efficiency and for demonstration projects, because we think, first of all, the utility of the future will be as much in the business of helping its customers control their energy cost as it will be in building new plants. And secondly, in a rising rate environment, the best thing you can do for the customer is help them keep their bill down. Because although rates may go up, your bill can stay the same if you use it more efficiently. So we have a heavy focus on that, which includes some demonstration of new technology. So we have the first two plug-in hybrids in the state, I guess Ann can show you one.
Yeah, one of them is here.
But they're the first two vehicles that have been converted. We're the first. There may be another one by now. I'm not sure. Priuses that are converted.
So they're entirely electric? Or?
No, they're standard Prius, but the plug-in has an additional large lithium battery. And what it is you plug it in at night, which helps the electric load even out. And since we buy all green energy from here, we say they're wind powered. And then the first 40 to 50 or 60 miles, it really depends, that you run, particularly if it's around town, would be all electric. But then when you get out on the highway, it's just like a normal Prius. So after a while on the highway, it'll get 50 miles to the gallon. But in town, for the first 35 to 50, 60 miles, it would be over 100 miles to the gallon. It costs about 50 cents to recharge it at night, and so you're paying 50 cents instead of $3.
What do those vehicles cost?
The conversion is about $12,000, but they're not commercial. You can't get them anyplace. You have to get in line now. We had ours ordered, and they kept getting delayed, and we discovered that our competitor was Google, that bought six of them, and they apparently had a little higher profile than we did with the converters. but we use them in the member communities to show what, you know, what can be done out there. We also have a program for members to use all-electric vehicles that they're manufactured in Reedsburg. They're kind of like golf carts, but they're all-weather. So members can use them for meter reading and things.
What are those called?
Pack something or other, right? They're all electric.
The company is Columbia Park Car, and the vehicles are all electric. I want to say that $7,500 is about the very base price, and our incentive is $5,000, I think.
But a number of members are looking. You have to get local ordinances changed, and then have to deal with the State Department of Transportation, which doesn't, you know, now will allow them to cross the highway, but doesn't want them to go down the highway. You know.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of potential there. But you were asking about the green zero net energy house, which, what do we call that?
Green Max House.
Green Max House. That's a incentive where we have, we're doing an RFP, and about two or three, we'll accept two or three, so it won't be in 49 different communities. But it's to individuals or builders who want to build this kind of home. And we will give a grant to cover some of the incremental cost over a traditional home in exchange for being able to have people tour it every once in a while and use it as a demonstration and learn more about the technologies.
What has the response been so far?
Well, the RFP is out, so we're waiting for responses.
Yes.
I think we'll get quite a few.
Yes, and because my name was associated with the press release, I actually got a lot of the calls, although I'm not coordinating the program, but so anecdotally, I think we certainly got a lot of response.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of
what other things is your utility doing to things you just talked about?
Oh, well, one of the major projects we have is up in River Falls. You know, the governor announced that he was going to use four campuses, were going to be models of efficiency and use of local renewables. He called it off the grid. I'm not sure that's quite correct, because I think you still need to be connected to the grid for reliability. But one of those campuses is River Falls, and that falls in our area. So we talked to the state and have moved ahead in partnership with the university to help them meet the governor's goals. And I think we're quite a bit out ahead of the other campuses, because just the state process will take a long time. So we're I'm going up to talk to the regents meeting this week on it, but we're doing a baseline so the university knows exactly what the consumption is and where it is and what the most cost-efficient, obvious improvements that can be made. So we're working with the chancellor up there, who's very enthusiastic. They've started this, I think it's the first sustainability graduate degree program. But we've taken it a step further. We have asked for two of our members to be pilots to show what a community can do if you get the leadership of the community, business, schools, the influential folks in the community, a committee, to really put a focus on efficiency and conservation. Electric is where we're focused. And we thought, since we were working with the university, River Falls would be a perfect model, because while we're putting a fair amount of effort, dollars and manpower in helping the university, they could help the community be a model simultaneously. You know, students could be very helpful, and the professors. So we're doing that, and we're looking for one other WPPI community to show how much can be done. We started on this because we started a renewable energy program. We have fair amount of renewable energy because we're going to meet the 2015 goal by the end of 08, I think. So we have our members marketing it, and traditionally, you know, you go out and send the flyers out and you get maybe 3% of the customers sign up. But one of our mayors issued a challenge to the community and, you know, publicized it in Lodi, and the sales just shot up, you know. And so that got a couple other mayors. Mayor of River Falls saw that, and he did his own, and now River Falls is in the top 10 in the country, I think, percentage-wise, in sales of renewables. And we've got maybe 10 mayors now sort of competing.
When you say sales of renewables, that means?
Signing up to pay a slight premium to have your power come from, to buy a block of wind power for your house or whatever. It's a mixture of wind and hydro and landfill gas.
And I think you said this building is 100%?
Well, we do it because we have signed up with Sun Prairie Utility to buy all of our requirements from our own wind resources, and then we have a solar, major solar panels out
there. Yeah, I think I saw those when I was downstairs.
So when you combine those two together, our bill is a little higher than it would be if we bought traditional power, but we're supplementing it.
What are your wind resources?
Well, our first ones were two large windmills in Worthington, Minnesota that we owned. The wind resource much better out there. We've had those for several years. We have a 50 megawatt entitlement out of a project in Iowa, top of Iowa, which MG&E is also in. And the power is going to come, first units are operational this week top of Iowa. We have contracted for all the output out of the project to be built between Hustisford and Hartford.
Where?
Between Hustisford and Hartford, Wisconsin, that is about 52 megawatts. I'm not sure what the name of that one is. Butler Ridge. But these things are financed for the tax credits by, I think it's Toshiba or somebody, I'm not sure, but you know, behind the scenes, who knows who gets tax credits. We don't want to own them and operate them because we don't have the staff or the skills. So, and the economics with the tax credits, it's better for a developer to do it and for us to contract for the output. And then we only pay if it generates.
Right.
And then we're doing 20-some out of the Forward project up by La Pond.
And how far away is that from
Remember?
Yeah, or from producing energy.
Forward is not under construction yet, nor is Butler Ridge is due to come on the last quarter of 08. And my guess is Forward is about the same time period.
I think so. There's a Power Report newsletter in your folder, and it lists all those resources and sort of the anticipated dates.
We're also trying to do up to 24 megawatts in member communities because we think that that will be a good focus. It's, you know, to have community-based systems.
And wind or?
Wind, primarily. Well, we do solar at schools and some demonstration wind, but utility-scale wind, which is big machines, a couple. And so we did an RFP, and we are trying to move forward in New Holstein, Westby, Kaquana. Wanakee was on the list, but it got pulled because it took less for the airport runway issues. The River Falls, we're doing wind monitoring. But you do run into, it's hard. There's a lot, no matter what you do, there tends to be opposition on siting.
I remember my grandparents' farm had a windmill.
Sure.
It seemed like everyone did it. Were those mostly for pumping water?
Yeah.
Or is... Could farms, you know, not in suburbia probably, but could farms put small-scale windmills up, or are those
probably... There are small-scale winds. There are companies that are selling them to individuals to put up with their homes, like, just like these solar panels. It is, you know, unfortunately, the economies of scale are significant, so if you're putting up 100 big ones, it's a lot less expensive than the small ones. But you're going to see more development, and as states require utilities to have more and more renewable resources, I think ultimately that will drive the price down. Right. Initially, it drives it up because the demand is there, right, and the manufacturing capacity is not. But over the long term, I think you'll see the price cost of solar come down.
Where in Iowa is the top of Iowa?
Kansas, Iowa? No, geographically.
It's in northeastern Iowa,
so not
but a ways from the border. It's in, you know, maybe, but I'm not, I'd have to, we have a map somewhere, so I'm sure I'll tell you.
I could probably just it
doesn't matter, interestingly, to us, because it's on the what we call the MISO transmission system, and anything on that grid we can purchase from today without going through all the fights in the past about trying to get transmission service. So, and the cost over there is significantly lower than in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has a mediocre wind resource.
Is that because of the driftless area, that it's rumpled there? Does it kill the wind blowing from the west?
Well, I think it's coming all the way from Denver, from Boulder, where college, you know, it's just they have better wind. The Dakotas, western Minnesota, and Iowa, Buffalo Ridge is a really good wind site.
But I mean, when it gets to Wisconsin, is it the rumpled area of the driftless that kills it?
It must be. But Wisconsin, you'd be doing well if you hit a 30 to 31% availability factor. Minnesota, you get into the high 30s and sometimes into the 40s. And that has a huge impact on cost. I think they will be looking, there will be increased pressure to look at Great Lakes wind in the future, because you will have better wind out there. But that's really tricky.
For aesthetic reasons, or?
There'll be opposition for aesthetic reasons, but where it has been done in Holland and
Denmark,
it's shallow for a long way out, and that's not the case with the Great Lakes. So the feasibility of it.
With your background, were you always interested in energy, or how did you get to where you are now?
Energy. No, I was an English major in college. So no, I got into it because after I went to law school, I practiced law in New York for a year, and primarily, the representation out there is the security industry and banks, investment banks. I didn't enjoy that. Came back here to the Boardman Law Firm, and one of their clients was some municipal utilities, and actually I got involved in suing some antitrust actions in the old days. And,
suing bigger utilities?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
What
did you work with, have to work with now?
We ended up representing all the municipals in the state of Wisconsin, some co-ops, and I represented the municipal utilities down in Illinois for a while. Some in Minnesota, mostly before the Federal Power Commission and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and then court proceedings. And then I represented the cities in Wisconsin when they created WPPI, the drafted legislation, and we lobbied it in the late 70s.
When was WPPI created?
The legislation was in 77. I think we were created in 1980 and first started selling power in 81. We had a lot of opposition initially. We went from 45 down to 23 when we had to get contracts approved by city councils, because we were opposed by some of the large utilities that the lights would go out and that whole kind of thing. But that relationship is, we're now here to stay, and we're a significant player. We're larger than Madison Gas in terms of our load. And with Gas and Electric, now they're a bigger company because they own all the distribution lines, and our members own the lines. Now we're partners with Lee Energy and their new plant. We're their largest customer also for power. Mm-hmm. And we're probably WPNL's
largest individual customer?
Yeah, we're probably WPNL's largest customer also, I think. So we have buy, and we also generate.
Um, You're on the board of American Transmission Company as well?
Yes.
How do you feel about the transmission line that that's may go along the Beltline or may go south?
Well, you know, we fought hard to get transmission ownership because transmission is the key to this business. You can't reach your resources without access to transmission. So most of my career was, what legal career was fighting for transmission access and opening up the grid, which has finally occurred. And we wanted a piece of ownership in the system, so we had a seat at the table as to what's planned and built. So ATC has been a major accomplishment for WPPI. We helped, I think we were a primary mover in the legislation and in the formation, and we own about 5.5%, so about $45 to $50 million investment. Wisconsin has the weakest transmission system in the Midwest by a fair margin, and that's because of the two Great Lakes, which means we don't have the kind of access Indiana has in four directions, and because we have shied away from building for a long time. It's so unpopular that a utility, most unpopular thing a utility does. So if the choice is build a transmission line and incur all the bad PR that goes with it, or build a power plant in California or Brazil or someplace, the money went elsewhere.
Right.
So the quid pro quo that Governor Thompson backed was divestiture into a company that's solely committed to building our infrastructure in exchange for getting out of some of the investment restrictions from outside. And that deal was struck. ATC has been building much more than it was built before, but we still have a very weak transmission system, which means that we have reliability, you know, potential reliability issues if we lose, for instance, if the nuclear power plants don't operate, it's very hard to bring power into the state because you can't maintain the voltage. So we have supported the construction program, and particularly the line from Duluth down to the central part of the state, which will be finally done in January. The line may be done in before that, but the substation will be January. And the Madison area improvements, our view is they are clearly needed. Look at the growth in Verona, Fitchburg, and and how many years it's been since we've had infrastructure improvements. So our position is, to the extent that people don't want lines, you've got to conserve now because utilities are going to build to meet their legal obligation to serve, and they can't build on the speculation that something is going to happen, that, you know, there's going to be a radical change, that we're not going to need the power. So we do think it's needed. We don't take a position on the specific route. It's really ATC's job to propose alternative routes, and the Public Service Commission's unenviable task to pick what is has the least detrimental impact, because no transmission line will be popular. So you've got to pick the one that has the best cost profile and the least environmental impact. And that will be, I don't know how that will turn out. I mean, there's a fairly good argument that the Beltline is not exactly a pristine corridor, but on the other hand, there's space issues,
right.
Undergrounding issues. Undergrounding is very expensive, and from our perspective, if you have a fault, it's very hard to, very expensive, hard to repair. And very time. I mean, if a line goes down, you can get it back in service, you know, quickly. But if an underground falls, that's a whole different ballgame.
Fault meaning fails.
Yeah, well, a fault develops. There was one in Connecticut, major underground, which developed some fault somehow, and it took them almost 6 months to get the thing back into service. So,
Anything I didn't ask you about energy and hot topics these days?
I don't think so. Pretty much covered the map.
All right, thank you.